This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. In 1960, more than a million people in rural North Carolina were living in poverty. By the year 2000, with a much larger population overall in the state, the number of those living in poverty in North Carolina was put at about 500,000 people. Many of those living in poverty are living in rural counties. Some of the rural counties also have high jobless rates, low education levels, and low literacy rates, and large numbers of people living without health insurance. 11 of the 16 counties in northeastern North Carolina fit this description, which is perplexing because 40 years ago, when the war on poverty began, the western part of the state and its rural counties were also considered poor. But in the west, the poverty rates have gone down over the past 40 years, while in the northeastern part of the state, they persist. And so this hour, as we continue our series, North Carolina Voices Understanding Poverty, we take a look at rural poverty and the northeastern part of North Carolina. We welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. Should those living in poverty just pack up and seek jobs in the metro areas? Or is there something that can be done to improve the ailing rural economies? If you live in rural North Carolina, what's your take? What's the best way to bring down the poverty rate? Our number is 1-877-962-9862. Well, with us this hour to help try to answer some of this is Jason Gray, who is Director of Policy and Research for the Southern Rural Development Initiative. Thanks for being here, Jason.
My pleasure.
And also here is Al D'Elia, Director of Federal Relations at East Carolina University. Thanks for coming in, Al.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Jason Gray, first, I think we need a definition. When we're talking about rural poverty, what is it that makes it different from urban poverty, aside from the very obvious that it's out in the country as opposed to in the city areas of the state?
Well, I think the biggest difference that anyone who works in rural America could point out is that the issues of isolation, both individual isolation from families, families isolated from communities, and then poor communities isolated from a wider regional economy or the national economy, is really the key defining trait of rural poverty that makes it different from poverty of someone who is poor living in a thriving metro region. Statistically, another difference between rural and urban poverty is that typically child poverty is much, much higher in rural America. And that's certainly the case in North Carolina. The child poverty rate is 45% higher in our rural counties than it is in our urban areas. Mm-hmm. But it is defining poverty not just in a sense of income, but in assets and savings and the type of savings one has, but also the ability to connect. It is this isolation that I think is a defining factor of rural poverty.
Well, I wonder, to turn the phrase about the poor will always be with us in some manner or other, can we say that isolation will always be with us? Because by definition, rural areas are spread out. And so you will have people who are living far apart from each other?
Well, isolation certainly will always be a factor. I mean, South Dakota is always going to be an isolated region. But what's happening now in our digital economy is that there are many different kinds of isolation. The physical isolation remains an economic reality. But more than ever, rural communities were once defined by cultural isolation due to lack of access to information and connection to a wider world. That kind of isolation is radically reducing. Mm-hmm. So the definition of rurality and isolation that we use is also changing.
Mm-hmm. You make the case that the poverty is not just based on low income, because there's this particular phenomenon in rural areas. More people who would fall below the poverty line than you might expect own their homes or own the land that their homes are on.
Yes. You'll see the home ownership rates generally in the rural South and in rural North Carolina are around 74%. However, that's a little bit misleading, because in low-wealth areas where what you'll see is over the past 10 years has been a tremendous growth in manufactured housing as the choice of housing for folks. And up until very recently, that's largely been purchased as personal property, not as real estate. So it'll never be an appreciating asset in the sense that we often think about home ownership. So one of the strategies that SRDI and others across the state and the region are looking at is that how do we make manufactured housing more of an asset building strategy?
How do you do that?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with seeing that it's mainstreamed like typical site-built homes, seeing that it's financed with a regular mortgage by a bank rather than by a personal loan, seeing that there is a resale market, that it gets included in the in a locality's home listings, seeing that the units are tied to the land on a permanent foundation, and that they're sited in a way which would maximize potential. But a lot of it has to do with geography. I mean, there's places here in Wake County where manufactured homes in a very well-developed neighborhood are appreciating at similar rates to site-built homes. Mm-hmm. That is not the case in our low-wealth counties, rural counties.
Could it be location, location, location?
That's a part of it, yeah. Because we see even in our most isolated, poorest rural areas, site-built housing is not a real asset-building mm-hmm. Vehicle because it's simply such a weak market.
Right. 1-877-962-9862 is the number. We are talking this hour on the state of things about rural poverty, poverty in the rural parts of the state. And we'll be focusing in particular this hour on the northeastern part of North Carolina, which 40 years after the war on poverty began, persists in having a large swath of that area being listed as persistently poor. That is, about 20% of the population remains below the poverty line over the past 40 years. I want to bring Al D'Elia in the conversation now. Al, you're with East Carolina University. Why is it that the western part of the state in the past 40 years saw a drop, a rather drastic drop, in its mm-hmm. the poverty rates in a lot of rather poor rural counties in the mountains, and yet this problem remains in the northeastern part of North Carolina?
Well, Melinda, that's a good question. It's a question that actually arose for us about 5 or 6 years ago. We were involved at East Carolina with a number of partners throughout the northeastern part of the state, the councils of governments and others. And quite literally in a conversation, somebody said, you know, I've been in North Carolina 35 years dealing with economic development issues, and it seems to me that there was a time that western North Carolina and eastern North Carolina were in the same economic basket. It wasn't a particularly good basket, but it was the same basket, and things have changed. That really prompted us at ECU to research that question and find the answer. And what we did was take two cohorts of counties that in 1960 were essentially identical statistically in terms of the economic statistics. And what we found is that the 12 counties in the western part of the state, as we moved them forward through time, improved economically. And the 15 counties that we looked at in the northeastern part of the state actually declined economically. And as you said, that makes no sense. In the same state with the same economic development policies and so forth, there should be a much more similar development pattern. So the next question we asked was, well, why did this happen? And the answer to that question was really a federal-state partnership that intervened in the West where there was no such partnership in the East. And that partnership is the Appalachian Regional Commission. It was created in 1964, came online in 1965 under the Johnson administration. And it covers part of 13 states in the Northeast along the spine of the Appalachian Mountains, as far north as New York, as far south as Mississippi. And literally billions and billions of dollars have been invested in infrastructure, in economic development projects, in education projects, in healthcare, and on and on and on, to help bootstrap the western part of the state.
So why didn't they do this in the eastern part of the state? Because they could look at the numbers back in 1960 and say, well, the eastern part of North Carolina is poor too.
Sure. I think one of the reasons it didn't happen in the eastern part of the state, in fact, didn't happen anywhere else in the country for another 30 years, was because the attention was focused in the mid-1960s on the Appalachian region. You'll recall, maybe you won't recall, but there are people out there that will recall that when Senator Kennedy ran for president in 1960, the primary to turn it around for him and allowed him to win was in West Virginia. One of the reasons he was able to win in West Virginia was because he focused on poverty. And his brother, Bobby Kennedy, who was running the campaign, saw that poverty and really began to highlight it. When he got to the Senate and when President Johnson came into office, that focus on poverty remained on the Appalachian region of the United States, and rightly so. There was a great deal of poverty, and in some areas of the Appalachian region, there continues to be a great deal of poverty. So the national focus was on this national sore spot, and no one ever really looked at other regions of the country, because other regions of the country, when you looked at large regions, seemed to be improving. Well, over the ensuing 40 years, what we saw is that there were regions of the country that didn't really improve very much. And we saw that in the Mississippi River Delta, where in the late 1990s, President Clinton and Trent Lott, working together, created the Delta Regional Authority, similar to the Appalachian Regional Commission. There's a similar commission that was created in Alaska to deal with the rural poor in Alaska, the Denali Commission. And I won't go through all of them, but there are three or four commissions across the country that are focused on these pockets of poverty. Mm-hmm. The one place where that hasn't happened is the southeastern United States, and it's the one place where statistically we're worse off than just about everywhere else in the country in terms of the need for this kind of a federal program.
Jason Gray, would that be the silver bullet?
Well, I think we have a need for a lot of necessary needs, but no one alone is going to be sufficient. What we've seen over 40 years is a reduction in poverty, and certainly now when you look at a map of persistently poor counties across the United States, what is so striking compared to 40 years ago is that outside of Appalachia, almost all the persistently poor counties are communities of color. They're black, they're Latino, they're American Indian, and race is a huge factor now in rural poverty.
And we will get to more of that in just a moment, but we have to take a quick break right now at the state of things. We're talking about poverty in rural North Carolina. Jason Gray is Director of Policy and Research at the Southern Rural Development Initiative, and Al D'Elia is Director of Federal Relations at East Carolina University. Support for the state of things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava, and we're talking today about rural poverty in North Carolina as part of our series, North Carolina Voices, Understanding Poverty. Al D'Elia is with us. He is Director of Federal Relations at East Carolina University, where he has also been working on economic development and community engagement in eastern North Carolina. Jason Gray is with us as well. He is Director of Policy and Research at the Southern Rural Development Initiative. Jason Gray, just before the break, we were talking about why it is that poverty seems to have been tamped down, at least, has gone down in the mountains of North Carolina over the past four decades, but not in the eastern part of the state. Al D'Elia was making the case that there was this big federal effort pumping billions of dollars into Appalachia, and that helped get economic development going there and reduced poverty. You're making the case, and our question is, why did it work in the West and not the East? Al was saying it was that development initiative, and you were saying we should not overlook the issue of race because
that's
the counties
well,
that remain.
I certainly agree with Al that I think the ARC has made a tremendous impact all across the broad ARC region. But we also have to put this in the context of race. The poorest counties, rural counties in North Carolina have the highest African-American populations. We see that all through the South. We see that in Latino and in Native American communities all across the country. And there's that residual isolation, and in the case of eastern North Carolina, a long history of racial injustice, which only now are we getting over the civic anemia of being able to for communities to work together as a region and go forward. So there's been that whole history. Another part of it is just the structure of the economy has been different. The agricultural focus on crops, which are now being phased out, even though there's been a huge amount of federal money that has gone into eastern North Carolina in peanut and cotton subsidies over the past 10 years, which is the federal government's main economic development sort of impetus into the region.
Agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Relatively little in terms, for example, there is now a program for the trade adjustment assistance for workers who have lost their jobs. You know, the textile factories have closed. In 2003, we had $41 million come to the state from the federal government for the trade adjustment assistance for workers program, but $93 million for direct subsidies, crop subsidies for for crops, mainly peanuts and cotton and corn. So it's a complex story. But what we do see is that in the Tier 1 counties, the state of North Carolina has a five-tier ranking of every county in the state, with the Tier 1 counties being the poorest and the worst off. That in the 90s, the poverty levels reduced, both absolutely and a percentage by percentage, in those Tier 1 counties. In the other Tier 2, Tier 3 counties, which the state would consider distressed, the population and poverty numbers increased dramatically. Overall, in the 90s, we had 128,000 more people in poverty in 2000 than we did in 1990. But in our very poorest rural counties, those Tier 1 counties, which are in the Northeast, we did see an absolute net reduction, and that is good news. But the increase in poverty in the Tier 2, Tier 3 counties, I think, reflects the huge economic dislocation that has happened because of the textiles and agriculture.
Melinda, you mentioned whether this was a silver bullet, the proposal that's in Congress now to create something called the Southeast Crescent Authority, which would pattern after the Appalachian Regional Commission. I don't think it's a silver bullet, but it's one of several bullets that have to be aimed at this problem. I think Jason's absolutely right. The roots of poverty are many and diverse. You look at education attainment levels, and they track very closely with the depth of poverty that you're looking at in the region. If you're looking at income levels, if you're looking at health status, all of those things, the more poor a region, the more poor are those statistics. So what really is needed is a broad-based, multifaceted approach, because poverty is not solved by solving one of the components of it. You need to work on education, you need to work on healthcare, you need to work on worker training, you need to work across the boards. And one of the beauties of the Appalachian Regional Commission, and one of the reasons why so many members of Congress, nearly all the members of Congress and in the Senate here in North Carolina and throughout the other six southeastern states that are part of the Southeast Crescent Authority, are supportive of it, is because other than the federal money, money is always good, but money is rarely the only answer. And in the proposal that is before Congress, the money that would come to these seven southeastern states, or parts of these seven southeastern states, is about $40 million a year. There's a proposal for $50 million, there's one for $40 million, which isn't a whole lot of money when you think about it. Although what we have seen in our research is that for every one of those federal dollars that has gone into the Appalachian Regional Commission, you see 10 additional dollars that are invested in those projects. Yes. And you would similarly see something like
that. Is it like seed money?
It is exactly like seed money. Jesse White, who was the past national co-chair of the Appalachian Regional Commission, is now at UNC Chapel Hill, is a good friend. Jesse said when he was chairman of the ARC that the money that the ARC puts into a project is rarely the money that is rarely the biggest amount of money, but is always the money that holds the project together. It's either the first money in or the last money
That's
in.
Right.
So it's the glue that holds the project together, which is what we would expect in the Southeast Crescent. More importantly, though, and this is something that is often overlooked, is that to have this state-federal partnership with the governors of the seven states functioning as the governing board of this organization, it requires that all federal dollars coming into those regions of those states are coordinated. So you don't have the Department of Labor spending money in Wilson, North Carolina, while the Department of Education spends money in Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina, while the Department of Housing and Urban Development spends money in Rocky Mount. All those things could happen, but for a change, those dollars would be coordinated, so you're attacking more than one source of poverty. And I mentioned three locations, all of which happen to be more or less urban. The same holds true for very small, very rural communities. There is very little coordination. And so this kind of a federal-state effort would provide that kind of coordination of federal dollars and federal resources, which has never happened before in the eastern part of the state. So that's one of the real highlights of this kind of an initiative. It's not a silver bullet, but at least, you know, we'd be taking steps in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Jason?
I think that's certainly the case. I think one thing everyone would agree on, that rural communities will survive when they start thinking regionally, when they start working together to both on the policy level to look for their commonalities, because so much of what happens when rural communities have needs from the state or the federal government, it's what I call retail politics. You know, we need this bridge, we need this water system, rather than communities of like-minded conditions working together to say, look, we need a coordinated strategy. We need to work regionally. We need to work towards regional differentiation so that that the products coming out of an area are distinct to those to that region, so that that's like with any product you would buy off the store shelf, you're seeing something that's unique and valuable about that region. And when that happens, you'll start seeing the kind of coordination and growth that we all hope for.
Mm-hmm. I think Jason's absolutely right. And you're seeing that in northeastern North Carolina. You're seeing that really throughout rural North Carolina beginning to happen. Some areas it's happening more successfully than in others. I have friends that have lived in very successful urban regions of the state that ask me from time to time, why can't you folks in the rural East get your act together? And my response was, when you're fighting over crumbs, it's very difficult to give away your little crumb to somebody else. When you have a table of plenty, it's very easy to pass that second piece of pie off to somebody else who may need it. So that's what the situation has been in rural North Carolina, is communities have been scrambling to try to keep their head above water, and they've been fighting with each other over crumbs. Fortunately, as Jason has indicated, that is beginning to change, and I think we're starting to see some of the fruits of that change now.
You know, you look at some of the list of, and as you described a moment ago, Jason, the tier one through five counties, and that the lower the number, the more impoverished the county is. Now, you have in the northeastern part of the state, you know, we have the Hyde and Hertford and Halifax counties as being tier one. But then tier three, we see Dare and Currituck. So it's not like all the counties in the northeastern part of the state, Pasquotank even.
Counties.
What are they doing that the Hertford and Hyde, or is it just some circumstance of birth or geography?
I think it's circumstance of geography and geology. when you take a look at Dare and some of the coastal counties, if you take a look at the swath of wealth compared to the swath of poverty in those counties, if you go about 20 miles inland from the beach, you'll find lots and lots and lots of poverty. So the reason those are tier three counties rather than tier one counties is because you've got this high wealth development along the coastline that you can't have in inland counties, of course. So that's largely the case throughout the southeastern United States. If you take a look at a rural South Carolina, go 20 miles inland from Myrtle Beach, and it's poor. If you go to rural Georgia, rural Alabama, Florida as well, if you go inland 20, 30 miles from Florida, with a couple of exceptions in terms of pockets of wealth like Orlando, you've got this, a very similar situation.
So are we talking here that the economies of those places would be based on tourism and people buying second homes, maybe people retiring to those? Is that the economy? So then all of a sudden land values go up.
And that creates its own set of problems. One of the other parts of the narrative for why Western North Carolina has been doing so much better is that many of those counties are defined by the Economic Research Service of USDA as high amenity counties. These are counties in the that are in the mountains, the Intermountain West, counties along the coast. They're attracting second home development. They're attracting retirees. They're attracting digitally connected folks who can live wherever they want.
And what is the amenity? Is the amenity the
physical
of the geography?
Generally, it's physical amenities.
Okay.
So you've seen a lot of growth in the western counties. You know, you look at Buncombe County. You know, Asheville is now one of the hottest areas in terms of a small city in the country. And what that masks is that there still is a great number of low wealth people there, but now they're being stressed in different ways. They can't afford to live in the communities they grew up in. They can't afford to buy a home there. They're having to commute distances. They're still losing factory jobs. There's jobs available, but they tend to be more low wage service jobs. So even the high amenity counties have their own specific set of conditions that working people and working families and the working poor have to confront, which may be qualitatively a little bit differently from a persistently poor county that's very, very isolated that nobody's moving to. I might add that in coastal North Carolina, what I think we have the potential to see is that in the small towns along the Albemarle Sound on the western side of the Sound have some real potential for growth. For the first time, three, 4 years ago, I went through Edenton. And Edenton is just a lovely little town, and it has great potential, and it's really building on that potential. And there's more stories like that that need to be told, and I think we'll see in the future.
Absolutely. I think Jason's right on target with that. Melinda, you asked at the beginning of the show why it is that all these poor folks in rural counties don't just pick up and move to the big city.
It was a hypothetical question.
Right,
yeah.
But it's a question that's often asked. And the reasons that that doesn't happen is because, again, poverty has lots of parents. And one of the reasons that these folks can't pick up and move is they have low skill levels in terms of jobs. They've lost their job, which was likely a fairly low skill or no skill manufacturing job. And those jobs have disappeared everywhere, not just in rural areas. So the set of skills that they bring to the table is a set of skills that is no longer wanted at the table. Yeah. They don't have the financial wherewithal, even if they wanted to pick up and move. So they're really trapped. And they're trapped, and the situation is getting worse, as Jason just described, because the situation around them is changing. And they're really stuck between a rock and a hard place with nowhere to go.
We're talking with Al D'Elia from East Carolina University and Jason Gray, who is with the Southern Rural Development Initiative, about poverty in rural North Carolina. And in particular, we're focusing on the northeastern part of the state. And with us now is Rick Watson, who is president of the Northeast Partnership. It encompasses 11 of the state's most 20 most economically distressed counties, and it's his job to try to drum up economic development in this part of the state. Welcome, Rick Watson.
Thank you.
Hi. Well, you do a lot of recruiting business and industry from outside the state, and we've just been talking about some of the challenges that are there for placing businesses in North Carolina, in rural North Carolina. What's the biggest challenge you face when you have to go out and make your pitch?
Well, identifying exactly where we are, helping them understand once we tell them Northeast North Carolina that they're not still looking around in South Carolina to find us. Identifying where we're actually located at and some of our accomplishments in the past and how we did it, you have to get your story across.
Yeah, well, give us your pitch. You're on a cold call, you're going into somebody and you're saying, you ought to come on down to Northeastern North Carolina or come over to Northeastern North Carolina. What do you say?
Well, we first try to tell them where we're at, and that is that we're located between I-95 and the Outer Banks, which most people do identify with I-95 and the Outer Banks. We're in the northern part of the eastern region of North Carolina, adjacent to Tidewater, Virginia, and that we have a lot of common ground, common areas, share a lot of labor, and that we've had a couple success stories in the last few years thanks to the state of North Carolina, Department of Commerce, and the leadership in the state of North Carolina. We talk about Nucor because they had a lot of notoriety. We talk about the Lowe's Distribution Center. And then we talk about the existing businesses that are there that can support them.
Mm-hmm. Now, Nucor, we should say, is a $300 million steel recycling facility in Hertford County. From the Northeast Partnership website, you list a number of these accomplishments: 86 new jobs in Halifax County from a Canadian company, Airbus; 100 new jobs in Elizabeth City from Tamsco; an Israeli shrink film manufacturer; 61 jobs in Martin County. How hard was it to get each of those to come in?
Well, the hardest part is getting to them, getting into the opportunity to meet, greet, understand. That's the hardest part. Once you can get your foot in the door, it's much like most sales. Personalities start to take over. The local people are very genuine as a rule, and each one of the projects that you just talked about, they looked at several communities. Those communities had either the right building and or infrastructure to support them. The local government appeared eager and energetic. We were able to do job fairs that verified that the labor was there, the skilled mm-hmm. labor they were particularly looking. So it took place through a series of steps, but the contact and getting your foot in the door was the most difficult part. The good news is when you announce one like that, there's a lot of joy in that, yay, we've got an announcement, but then there's another year's worth of work getting in the building, get it rectified, getting financing together, getting infrastructure improved, getting the people to take the proper applications to go to work at those organizations.
Now, you're a Tier 1, you have 11 Tier 1 counties, that is the most poor in the state. And I wonder, you know, that you have to talk, I guess, eventually confront the issue of the high unemployment there, which would represent, a willing workforce, people looking for jobs, but the poverty there and the lower education levels than one would find, say, in the Triangle. How do you make your pitch there? Is there a glossing over, or do you have to confront that eventually?
We confront it to some extent. A good salesman is going to talk about his I'm not talking about me, I'm talking about an organization. Mm-hmm. Any good sales organization is going to talk about its positives, not its negatives, and that try to point out that its negatives are actually its positives. For example, in Northeast North Carolina, we have not put our highways or our water and our sewer in the wrong place yet.
because you haven't put it in place yet.
There are some cities you can travel in that I will leave nameless that if you miss your exchange, you might actually have to go 15 miles to get back up on the interstate. So there are some advantages to not making those mistakes as of yet. And since we do industrial, commercial, travel and tourism, film, sports, heritage, tourism, not everyone in the tourism business or not everyone in the business industry has to have a specialized education and or training. And we do have a lot of people that work in the hotel, motel industry. So by having that wide gamut, I think some of the people that might be considered underemployed or undereducated or underskilled for a particular job actually does have a job. Maybe would like to have a better one that does have an opportunity anyway.
We are talking about economic development in rural North Carolina, in rural northeastern North Carolina. With us is Rick Watson, who's president of North Carolina's Northeast Partnership. We'll get back to our conversation with Rick Watson and with Al D'Elia, director of federal relations at East Carolina University, and Jason Gray, director of policy and research for the Southern Rural Development Initiative. We'll get back to our conversation on poverty in rural North Carolina in just a moment on the State of Things. This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. We're talking this hour about rural poverty and economic development. With us is Jason Gray, who is Director of Policy and Research for the Southern Rural Development Initiative, and Al D'Elia, who is Director of Federal Relations at East Carolina University and has also been working on research, economic development, and community engagement. With us, too, is Rick Watson, who is with the Initiative for the Northeast Partnership, trying to bring business to northeastern North Carolina to alleviate the poverty there. Well, Rick Watson, one final question for you. There, we're talking about attracting businesses there into northeastern North Carolina. There is news of a Dollywood potentially coming to northeastern North Carolina. This would be a theme park along the lines of Dollywood that Dolly Parton has set up in eastern Tennessee. Where does that stand right now?
Well, you have to remember with each of our clients, even our existing industry program, we sign non-disclosure agreements with all of our clients. I can talk about it in general. We started a couple of years ago trying to identify an entertainment venue. Only about 6 months ago, we were fortunate enough to have the opportunity to meet with Randy and Deb Parton, who is the brother of Dolly and Stella Parton, who has his own show and a theater out in Dollywood called the Pines Theater. In fact, he's the ambassador to Dollywood for her. And we worked with him for the last 6 months to evaluate and determine whether we could support that type of entertainment in the Northeast. And I'm very happy to say that all the economic impact studies and all the information from the celebrities themselves have come back very positive. And we anticipate a announcement of a number of theaters, hotel, motels, shopping centers probably around May the 15th to June the 1st, if everything goes well.
Now, would this be in one particular county, or would this be...
The first phase will be in one or two counties. The second phase will be in about three or four counties. We're attempting to do what we've always wanted to do, and that is stop traffic on I-95 for more than one night. And also, we've always talked about being able to bring travel and tourism between I-95 and Outer Banks to the Inner Banks. And I think we'll be able to accomplish theaters based on the initial responses in about 6 to 7 different counties in the Northeast. But it'll be the complete region will benefit from it.
Mm-hmm. Jason Gray?
Well, I think certainly development of this type might bring regional benefit in terms of tax revenue. And certainly all of these localities are starved for tax revenue. I would have some concerns over the quality of jobs being created by such a development strategy. They are not jobs that, in my view, would lead to much of a career path for individuals living in the region. I think Northeast North Carolina needs to diversify its economy a great deal, though I question whether entertainment development centers like Dollywood, which I've seen out in out in Tennessee, is the sort of development which really that we would want most of our children to work in, frankly.
Rick Watson?
If you would ship us a busload of brain surgeons, we'll build a hospital for them.
I think let me jump in here, Melinda, because I maybe it's because I've been spending too much time in Washington, but I agree both with Jason and with and with Rick. Rick, how are you doing?
Good. How are you, Adam?
I'm doing well. I think when you take a look at the partnerships in North Carolina and the relative success of each of the seven partnerships, I think what you'll find by almost any objective marker is that the Northeast Partnership is at the very top of the partnerships in the
Thank
state.
You.
And oh, you're welcome. I believe that sincerely. And one of the reasons that it has done so well is because they have figured out what they need to do in different parts of their region. What fits in Hertford County may not fit in Pasquotank or may not fit in Gates. So although on the statistics, I agree with Jason that jobs in the tourism entertainment industry may not be the ideal kind of job, they are entry-level jobs. They are jobs where none exist. And it has seemed that in the entertainment industry and in tourism, it is, if you will, a loss leader. It brings in other kinds of industries. It brings attention to the region. It brings some level of understanding of what else may be able to be done there. So it is a way to build. I would hope, and knowing Rick, I suspect that I'm right, that this is not their ultimate goal, but this is a first step for some of those counties that will lead to other things. So, again, when I was doing research and economic development and community issues in the eastern part of the state at ECU, what we did find was that tourism, jobs in tourism were not what you wanted, but very often it's what you can get, and it's better than having nothing at all. So I applaud the efforts, Rick, that you guys are making out in the Northeast, and continue much success.
Okay. Rick Watson?
I'd like to add, if I might, that the people in the Northeast are very proud of the tourism, and they expect tourism jobs to be sought after just as equally with as much enthusiasm as you do industrial and commercial. And after all, they're the people that live there. So to some extent, we have to support what they want, not force feed them. They've reminded me on a number of occasions that they've not been able to feed any of their children with statistics, only with money.
That's right.
Right. I wonder, though, Rick Watson, before you go, just something that Jason Gray brought up, and that was that a lot of jobs in tourism are not very high-paying. I mean, there's what we call the service sector jobs. And would we get into that phenomenon that if perhaps, a Dollywood came in, an entertainment facility came in, and then people found they couldn't live in that county anymore, as has happened in other parts of the state and the country, where the tourism just becomes so high dollar that the people who are changing the beds and working, you know, as short order chefs in the kitchen, short order cooks, can't afford to live where they've always lived.
I don't know how it has been in Branson, Missouri, Pigeon Forge, South Myrtle Beach. I suspect some of what you say may be true, but we're a large enough region, and we have a smaller population than any region in the Northeast, but we also have almost the largest land mass. I think we can accommodate good, wholesome family entertainment. A lot of those people are not minimum wagers. In fact, I don't know any of them that are. There may be a few. But the lighting people, the sound people, these are technology jobs that actually earn very good wages besides the entertainers. And as Al said, simultaneously we're working on an advanced auto research project for Northampton County in an attempt to attract Tier 1 and 2 automobile builders. At the same time, we've launched an existing industry program. We have a buyer-supplier network in which we're trying to get 600 industries to put in that buyer-supplier network who they buy from, who they sell from, and the 20,000 businesses through the chambers in that same software. And what we're trying to encourage them to do is buy from each other. Mm-hmm. They can solve the employment problem and improve their bottom lines if they just do business with each other rather than trying to do business with people outside the region.
Hey,
so
Jason,
there are several initiatives to do things more than just entertainment.
Jason Gray?
Yeah, I certainly understand and agree with Rick that of the dilemma that the region faces, that we need to grow any kind of job base in order to get some momentum, because the inertia is overwhelming in low-wealth counties like this. And it's frankly, it's a strategy we see across the country in the Mississippi Delta. There's been a growth of casinos along the Mississippi River. And there are many who believe that the growth of the casino industry has been the impetus to push development strategies, diversified development strategies, in very poor counties. So I think Al is right in that the real story here is that what happens, where does this fit into a larger strategy, and what happens afterwards? Because there are those in the Mississippi Delta who were very much against the casinos coming in, who now see it as spinning off some potentially good things. But too often we settle for the lowest common denominator. And rural counties, particularly the poorest rural counties, are often presented with the least preferable options, whether it's a low-wage industry like this, whether it's a prison, whether it's a waste facility. They're put in this position of having to accept less than optimal choices. Right. So I understand that.
Okay. Well, Rick Watson, I'd like to thank you for joining us. And May 15th is the day when there may be an announcement on this, on Dollywood?
There will be an announcement somewhere, probably middle May, 1st of June, on a series of theaters to be built in the Northeast.
Okay. Well, Rick Watson, thanks for being with us today.
Thank all of you for allowing me. I enjoyed it.
Okay. Good luck.
Rick Watson is president of North Carolina's Northeast Partnership, which tries to draw large businesses to come to the northeastern part of North Carolina. Joining us now is Leslie Scott, who is director of the Institute for Rural Entrepreneurship at the North Carolina Rural Economic Development Center. She's currently working on a program for dislocated workers in rural counties across the state. Thank you for being with us, Leslie Scott.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay. Well, you have been following economic and community development in North Carolina for the past two decades, but I understand that in the past 4 to 5 years, the focus has been on entrepreneurship, and we're talking here small businesses, different from what Rick Watson is working on. Why this focus now on the entrepreneurship, the small business person?
Well, from the Rural Center standpoint, I think our senior leadership saw an opportunity to bring a new kind of job growth to many of these rural areas that were seeing their large businesses laying people off. And so we're working on helping them develop what we call homegrown jobs, which are the ones that the communities and the individuals that live there figure out may provide enough of a market for somebody to make a living off of. And so in that program, the New Opportunities for Workers program, dislocated workers have the opportunity to get a free reality check on whether their business idea is viable, whether it has enough of a market to produce a revenue stream for that person. And for those people, then we can help them get the first microloan to get that business off the ground.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of approach are you taking? Are we talking here about seed money to, say, start a restaurant and help revitalize a now vacant downtown, or is there a different approach going on here?
Probably one of the most common calls that I get and that many of my partners around the state get is there free money to start my business? What we usually have to do is educate people that we can help you do a business plan where you demonstrate enough of a market so that you can make a living for yourself or for your family or what your particular objective is. If you plunge in riding on just an idea before you see if it's going to pay off, you could create a ticket to disappointment for a lot of people and financial loss, too, for people who particularly can't afford that. So really what the grant money that the community college system got through Workforce Investment Act funds at the federal level provides free tuition money to pay for the training for people to go through a class like North Carolina Real Rural Entrepreneurship Through Action Learning, which is a very hands-on course in is this a workable business idea. And then at the end of that process, they have a peer group in place that they can work with as they launch their business. Some of them may decide that they can't make a profitable business out of it, but they don't have any cash out. There's no loss for them to take if what they determine is my dream is not workable right now. It will help them make a more informed decision if they do decide to launch a business.
You've said in the past that part of your goal is to change the culture that you find among, say, workers who've been laid off. It's one about getting people to take an initiative, because I guess for years they had worked for companies, and now they're proposing being the company themselves.
Right? Yeah, well, we would take the approach that many of those business skills that it takes to see the employer's side of the picture can be taught. and that what you can learn in a program at your community college or through NC Real is whether you have something that is going to make enough of a business that you could make a living off of it. And some businesses don't have enough of a market to do that, but the steps people go through to figure that out then help them make a more informed decision, and then there's a support network of other people that have gone through the training at the same time where they can help each other, or as one of your speakers said earlier, buy local from each other just by supporting each other's businesses and slowly developing a local economy that has more invigorated small businesses in it just by working with one at a time.
Mm-hmm. Well, Leslie Scott, thank you for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Leslie Scott is director of the Institute for Rural Entrepreneurship at the North Carolina Rural Economic Development Center. With us are Jason Gray with the Southern Rural Development Initiative and Al D'Elia from East Carolina University. We're talking here about, you know, bringing jobs into a region, either Rick Watson's approach, which was to bring in large companies, attract them, what I understand some call the big buffalo hunt, right? And then Leslie Scott's approach, which is trying to get people to be entrepreneurs. Would that make a dent in the poverty issue that we see in northeastern North Carolina? I'm curious as we wrap up this hour whether those are the approaches or what do you see as
the important thing
to happen?
Both of those would make dents, but there are many more dents that need to be made. I mean, as has been said in the program before, you've got the issue of jobs and income that need to be created, but you also have the issue of health care. I know that you had the program yesterday where you talked largely about health care and health status. Northeastern North Carolina, if it were a separate state, would be 51st in the nation in every health indicator that you could look at. It's very difficult to have a healthy workforce when you don't have healthy people. The same thing with education. Education has to be improved and attained. So, again, there are many different avenues that have to be taken in order to solve this problem. The two that you mentioned are just two of many, but they are two of the right ones.
Mm-hmm. Jason Gray.
Rural entrepreneurship strategies are really taking root all across the country, and I think they certainly there is a national consensus that they can make a difference. I think particularly for very rural counties with very small populations and small workforces where the creation of 8, 10, 20, 30 jobs can make a big difference. So in the very rural counties with low populations, I think it can make a dent. But I think we need a diverse strategy, which, again, where everything is necessary but nothing alone is sufficient. North Carolina, relative to the rest of the South, is doing a lot of things right. You know, we've got the mix of philanthropy. We've got the North Carolina Rural Center. We've had good, strong civic leadership. But we've been overwhelmed by these massive global economic changes that has really been a major roadblock to reducing poverty in eastern North Carolina.
Well, I'd like to thank you both for being with us today to talk about this.
Thank
you so much. Jason Gray is Director of Policy and Research for the Southern Rural Development Initiative, and Al D'Elia is East Carolina University's Associate Vice Chancellor for Research, Economic Development, and Community Engagement. He's also Director of Federal Relations at East Carolina University. And that's the state of things for today. Support for North Carolina Voices Understanding Poverty comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University, Doug and Peggy Abrams, the Julian Price Family Foundation, Maupin Taylor, PA, the Michael and Laura Brader Arahe Foundation, and the North Carolina Humanities Council. Thank you, as always, for listening. If you have a comment about the program, you may drop us an email. Our address is sot@wunc.org. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Melinda Pencava.